On the program today, international trade as the economic bad guy from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 28th of July. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. I am no betting man, but this one's probably easy money. At some point in her acceptance speech tonight, Hillary Clinton is going to talk about international trade and how she is going to make sure the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, her old boss's big trade deal that is kind of, well, stuck in Congress, how she is going to make sure that it doesn't go anywhere unless and until it protects American jobs and American workers. Just a guess. But I'm pretty sure I'm right. What's interesting about that, among many, many things about this election that are interesting, is how a several thousand pages, literally 5 million individual tariff line items long agreement, is how that TPP has become a red-hot issue for both Democrats and Republicans. From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
President Obama faced heckling and anti-TPP signs during his speech at the Democratic convention. He's popular, but backs an increasingly unpopular trade deal, which Hillary Clinton once supported and now opposes. I heard the same message far from the conventions, in liberal Portland and the conservative ranch country of eastern Washington.
I coach the team roping, and then we've got calf ropers, goat tie, and barrel racing, and they do the bull
riding. I met rancher Neil Slater at a summer rodeo Bible camp where he volunteers. He's a pro-business Republican, and he's seen the rural West struggle.
I would have to agree with Trump. Free trade is one thing, but fair trade is something different. And the free trade has really hurt us as far as the wheat industry and the cattle industry.
In Portland, I talked to 22-year-old yoga instructor Larissa Jonkis, a diehard Bernie Sanders supporter. She doesn't believe Hillary Clinton's conversion on free trade.
I mean, I'm sure there's good things she could do. I'm just concerned about the bad things, like the TPP.
Now, this left-right alignment isn't unprecedented, says Jeffrey Schott at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
That's just a flashback to 1992 and the NAFTA debate, when Pat Buchanan and others on the right wing of the Republican Party allied with Ralph Nader and others on the left wing of the Democratic Party. Almost the exact same rhetoric.
But now the rhetoric has captured masses of voters in both parties. Partly, says Robert Scott at the Economic Policy Institute, because of NAFTA, which many voters blame for job losses and displacement.
Often we find that we have growing trade deficits with our partners in these deals. They're designed to encourage outsourcing. This also tends to put downward pressure on wages, so it hurts essentially all non-college educated workers.
And, says Scott, with a weak economic recovery and an election looming, pretty much the whole country is paying attention to jobs and wages and asking what government has done to make matters worse. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's easy to think political conventions are about the speeches and the pageantry and the sign waving, and they are to some degree, but they are also a business opportunity, a great chance for lobbyists to come and schmooze with decision makers all trapped in one convenient location. From my health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, as it happens, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein spent an afternoon with a woman who wants Congress to pony up more money for medical research.
The art of leaning in. That is Suzanne Folk's forte.
The key is really arriving early and trying to start the conversations before the program begins, and then staying after to see if you could connect with more people.
Folks is with Research America, a nonpartisan group that advocates for medical and scientific research. The organization lobbies and educates Congress on behalf of academia, patient advocacy groups, and major companies. Some top priorities include more dollars to develop a Zika vaccine and keeping the cancer moonshot going. On a blistering hot and humid Philadelphia afternoon, Folks flashes confidence and charm as she met Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer.
Hi, Congressman Suzanne Folks. I'm with Research America.
A Procter & Gamble executive.
I'm with Research America. We're a nonprofit advocacy alliance in outside Washington, D.C. and Arlington, Virginia.
Even a college kid at a brew pub.
Hey, hi. I'm Suzanne Folks with Research America.
Nice to meet you.
Folks is on the lookout for people who share interest in solving medical problems, and the parties and luncheons here are a great place to do it. Sheila Krumholz is with the Center for Responsive Politics. She says when the conventions come around, entire Washington lobbying firms have been known to pick up stakes and move operations to the host city. It's a smart play when you're in the business of selling influence.
It's much easier to have these conversations when people let their guard down, the champagne is flowing, the music is playing, there's a feast, lavish spread out.
One of the great things about conventions is the person who could really help your cause might be standing right next to you. But that person is easier to find when there's an incumbent president. It's all set up, says Dr. Georges Benjamin, head of the American Public Health Association. This year, he says, when it comes to public health and medical research, who that person is proving to be a challenge.
There's no question that I know very clearly who's interested in health on the Clinton campaign, and we are really struggling to figure out who's advising Mr. Trump.
Suzanne Folks with Research America has also reached out to both campaigns. She hopes soon the candidates will provide statements on how they want to advance medical research, though Hillary Clinton has publicly laid out several ideas already. In the meantime, Folks will keep working the room.
So the real question is, how many business cards did you get?
I'm working on it. I think I have half a dozen or more, but the day's not over yet.
Folks says you never know when you might meet some influencer who you can work with in the future. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, another treading water kind of day in equities. Bonds, too, if you're curious. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Think about every big Wall Street movie you've ever seen and who played the starring roles. Michael Douglas in Wall Street, Leonardo DiCaprio in The Wolf of, Christian Bale in American Psycho. It's always dudes in the biggest parts. Before you tweet at me, yes, Melanie Griffith co-starred in Working Girl, but she played a secretary in that one. When Hollywood puts a rich powerful banker in the lead role, it's generally a man. And while there is still a long, long way to go, there are a whole lot more women on actual Wall Street today than in the decades that those movies took place. You wouldn't know it from pop culture Wall Street, where women get mostly supporting parts, if any. But there are some hopeful signs. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York.
When the indie film Equity opens Friday, moviegoers will meet the character Naomi Bishop, the powerful and rich banker who drives the whole movie. Early on, the film sets a tone that it's a very different kind of Wall Street story. In this scene, Bishop is speaking on a panel of female leaders when a young woman asks what motivates her.
I like money.
Anna Gunn, multiple Emmy Award winner for her work on Breaking Bad, plays Bishop.
I am not going to sit here and tell you that I only do what I do to take care of other people, because it is okay to do it for ourselves, for how it makes us feel.
Sundance and Tribeca Film Festival screenings built buzz for Equity. Wall Street women have been excited about it for months.
There was so much in that script that I could identify with, and I could identify with the character of Naomi. I was interested right at the get-go.
That's Candy Strait, a longtime finance professional. When the producers came to her looking for advice and investment, she didn't just open her wallet. She signed on as executive producer and opened her address book. Other women she knew on Wall Street were eager to back a film with someone like them at the center.
Women probably financed 80% of the movie.
And she's quick to point out they made money when Sony Pictures Classics bought the film for $3.5 million. There are women in front of and behind the camera. The director and screenwriter are women, and two women produced it, including Alicia Reiner. She says she's a fan of some iconic Wall Street movies, but always found something missing.
Their portrayal of women is what made me, when we first started talking about this, go, I don't know if I want to do a Wall Street movie. And then seeing, we don't have to talk about it. We can change it.
She and Sarah Megan Thomas, the other producer, have their own company, Broad Street Pictures. Their goal is creating better opportunities for women in Hollywood, on screen and off. Like Reiner, Thomas performs in Equity.
That's why we want to put women as leaders on Wall Street in this movie, in this complex role that Anna Gunn plays wonderfully, because it's just there and we're changing what people see, which will then change how they feel about women in power.
Equity stands out because a high-level Wall Street woman is the main character, but there are signs it won't stand alone for long. This year's novel, Opening Bell, also revolves around a female banker. Author Maureen Sherry previously had a high-level job at a big Wall Street bank.
I did want to make a strong female character who is perhaps a little bit quirky and hopefully likable be that main character because I hadn't read a book like that.
We'll likely see a movie like that soon, too. Reese Witherspoon's production company snapped up rights to the book before it came out, with an eye toward Witherspoon starring.
I think the reason that there was interest from Hollywood was because there's a interest in having women who are strong and successful, not because they're beautiful, not because they're with the guy who happens to be the billionaire. And I think it just portends to what's going on in Hollywood, where there is this real focus now on getting women more involved in movies. It's kind of a wave, and I think the timing was right.
Hollywood has a real-life relationship with Wall Street, which expects movies to make money for shareholders. Whether more powerful women bankers command the pop culture spotlight will depend on whether audiences come out to support these kinds of stories. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up, you really get to know the kinds of people who are chasing this dream of playing professional football.
This very, very long shot dream. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 15 points today, less than a tenth percent, finished at 18,456. The NASDAQ up 15 points, nearly a third percent, 5154. The S&P 500 up 3 points, about a tenth percent. 2170. After the bell today, Alphabet, parent company of Google, said strong advertising revenues drove a 24% increase in quarterly profit. Its shares, which now sell for more than $800 a whack by the buy, are up 5% after hours. Amazon, also posted earnings after the close. Amazon shares rose 31% and profits hit a new record. Its shares, at about $760 plus a piece, are trading up 2%. Bond prices were flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note remained at 1.5%, 1.50%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're still pretty much right in the middle of earnings season. Lots of tech this week. Also, yesterday, Boeing. The plane maker reported its first loss in almost 7 years, which is bad. Near tragic, though, for the aviation aficionados among us, is that Boeing is thinking about ending production of its iconic 747, the original jumbo jet, after almost a half a century. You roll that in with the news earlier this month that Airbus is going to cut production on its not-even-close-to-iconic double-decker A380 Super Jumbo, and it seems size might not matter anymore. Ashley Milne-Tite reports on the end of an aviation era.
Chances are you've heard about the plane with a spiral staircase in first class.
This 1969 ad for Pan Am captures the marvel people felt at the first huge passenger jet.
And chances are you've wondered, who's going to get this incredible bird off the ground?
Michael Miller is an aviation consultant and the son of a pilot. He fell in love with the 747 at the age of 6.
So the wonderment of watching a 747 back in the 1970s is still part of my life today. I still love watching them take off.
But fewer and fewer are. Scott Hamilton is an aviation consultant in Seattle. He says only a few airlines are still ordering the planes.
Lufthansa, Korean Air are the two that immediately come to mind, but we're talking about 30 or 40 planes at best between them.
The 747, with its hundreds of seats and huge appetite for fuel, used to be the only plane that could fly long haul. Now airlines prefer smaller, more fuel-efficient planes that are easier to fill. Joe Brancatelli runs Joe Sent Me, a website for business travelers. He says high-paying business travelers want a plane every hour, not every 3 hours.
The smaller the aircraft, the more flexibility an airline can give you on how often you can fly.
Brancatelli, for one, won't miss the big bird. Still, Michael Miller says the 747 is part of aviation history.
It really echoes a time when people loved to fly.
How many people even remember that? I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The retirement underfunding dilemma in this country is a real one. Most Americans just don't have enough money put away. And that helps explain why more than half of the states either have or are considering laws that would create state-run retirement plans. Connecticut and Maryland are the most recent this year. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace has more.
When you talk to people who know a lot about retirement in the U.S., they tend to sound worried. Teresa Ghilarducci, a professor of economics at the New School, is one of these people. She says local governments will end up picking up the tab on everything from housing to health costs.
states and cities are the first line of defense on this crisis.
And low to middle income and Black and Hispanic people are the least likely to have any retirement savings.
To leave them high and dry without an option is really not an option, at least from a government perspective.
Kevin Lembo, Connecticut state controller, has worked to pass a state-run retirement fund there. It will require most private companies to offer some plan, though employees can opt out. A government board will oversee collective management of the funds. And that's what Republican State Senator Len Fasano from Connecticut has a problem with.
Government controlled and government invested and government oversight. And as long as government keeps their hands on it, I don't know if anybody's safe.
He says if people want to invest, that should be a choice. The trouble with that, says Teresa Ghilarducci, is that individual options like 401ks and IRAs can be confusing and risky. She thinks state-mandated funds are at least a stopgap.
In fact, if states could build a time machine so all their citizens could go back 10 years and start saving then, that would be a big help.
Of course, people have their own solution. Almost 40% of Americans say their retirement plan is to keep working or that they don't have a retirement plan. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
There are still 3 or 4 weekends between us and the start of college football season, but there's a new docu-series dropping tomorrow on Netflix that's going to be a good warm-up. It's called Last Chance U, following a season with the football squad at East Mississippi Community College out of Scuba, Mississippi. If you've heard of neither EMCC nor Scuba, I get that, but in the world of junior college football, East Mississippi is nothing less than a powerhouse. It's also, as the title implies, the last chance for players with promise who are out of options, players who have Division I college football skills, some of them even pro level, which means the stakes could not be higher. Greg Whiteley is the filmmaker for Last Chance U. Greg, thanks for coming on.
Great to be here.
I'm thinking maybe the place to start is to have you tell me a little bit about Scuba, Mississippi, population 716.
When you drive into town, as Drew Gerbera, the writer of the GQ article which this series is based, describes, there is one working Coke machine in the town of Scuba, Mississippi, and that's Scuba.
There are a couple of guys in this film that I want to talk about. The first one is, I guess he's an defensive lineman, right? Ronald Ollie.
That's right, number 90.
Big, giant, gentle giant kind of guy, but holy cow, he can play football, right?
Yeah, so as his position coach, Coach Williams, would describe, Ronald Ollie is he's 300 pounds and can move like a deer. And this is a very rare combination in a human being, to be that big and to be able to move that quick. And for long stretches of a game or even a practice, he is very gentle, and it would drive his coaches nuts. But at key moments, he can flip a switch and change a game. And we saw it happen over and over again.
All right, so here's the other thing about Ronald Ollie, though. And you do fall in love with his character because he's just, I mean, and I say this not pejoratively, he's like Goofy, right? He just likes to have a good time and hang around and play a little football. But then you get into the first day of classes, and he shows up after having been guided into what to do and how to go about class and all this stuff by the academic advisor, who's another character I want to talk to you about in a second. But he shows up for the first day of classes, and he didn't have the sense to bring a piece of paper and a pencil.
Yeah, well, this is not unusual. He's certainly not the only one of all those players that shows up to the first day of class not prepared for the first day of class. And that becomes a reoccurring theme throughout the series, that you have at this particular school, at this particular junior college football program, they have three kinds of players. One is a kind of player that shows up. No Division I program was going to extend them a scholarship because they just simply weren't good enough, but they just want to keep playing. And so they go to a smaller school like this just to keep the dream alive.
Mm-hmm.
The other type of player is a player that is there because they had a Division I scholarship, but it wasn't working out. So rather than sit out a year, they'll go to a high-profile junior college program like this to sharpen their skills. The third is somebody like Ronald Ollie, mm-hmm. where they're They have otherworldly talent, but many of them will show up to a place like SCUBA without traditional academic skills.
Literally not knowing how to do it, right?
Yeah. It seems strange to us that he wouldn't bring a pencil or a notebook, but to him, he hasn't quite figured that out yet.
How much of this film is about the sausage making, really, of football in America?
I love that phrase. I need to put that on the poster for this series, Kai. That's great.
Feel free. Go ahead.
I would say this is the first series that gives you the kind of access in which you really get to know the kinds of people who are chasing this dream of playing professional football. And because, and all credit goes to the coaches and the administration at East Mississippi, they were very proud of the kind of program that they have painstakingly built over the last 8 years. And they should be. It is remarkable what they do. But they completely opened their doors to us and gave us unfettered, unprecedented access. As a result, we do get to show, as you say, how the sausage is made. It's not always pretty.
Coach Buddy Stevens, the man who arguably built this program, how did he come to SCUBA, Mississippi?
Well, he is a product, at least coaching-wise, of the Mississippi Conference, Junior College Conference, which is the most competitive college football conference, junior college-wise. And the president of SCUBA, Mississippi, was sick of being everyone's homecoming school. Now, what I mean by that is you're a rival Mississippi school and you're going to have a homecoming game in which all your alumni are going to be coming back and you want to put on a show for them, you would schedule SCUBA to be your homecoming game because you knew you could just roll up on them.
You want a pat.
They were a guaranteed win.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he was tired. This president comes along and says he's sick of this. And he goes, I'm going to make some changes here. And it starts with hiring a good coach. And Buddy shows up, who is a bigger-than-life personality. Buddy, as the story was told to me, sat across from this college president and just said, it's as simple as this. You want to win? Hire me. And he delivered. In a matter of a few short years, he turns this doormat of a football program into the most prolific college, junior college football program in the country.
How much do you think the idea of potential weighs on these students? Because for the ones like Ronald Ollie and DJ Law, the running back, and some of the others, John Franklin III, the upside potential if they do well here is limitless. NFL and millions of dollars. Did you sense that weighs on these kids?
So Buddy Stevens has more players currently active in the NFL than the vast majority of Division I schools. So most of the kids on his 55-man roster have this weight that they are carrying around from the moment they step on campus. I don't think I've personally ever felt anything like it. But a school like EMCC has had enough success that it tempts kids after kids of unusual talent to come and roll the dice for 1 or 2 years in SCUBA, Mississippi, to see if they can make that happen.
Greg Whiteley's most recent film, you might know him from MITT, the Mitt Romney documentary a couple of years ago. His most recent film drops on Netflix tomorrow. It's called Last Chance You. It is, it's fascinating, I'll tell you that. Greg, thanks very much.
Kai, what a pleasure. Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, something to bear in mind perhaps on a Friday or a Saturday night. There was a study out in the American Journal of Epidemiology last week that shows Uber doesn't actually lead to the reduction in drunk driving that a lot of people thought it might. There is some research, academic and anecdotal, that does show a slight drop in people who shouldn't getting behind the wheel. But the common denominator appears to be this in all the studies. People who have had a couple too many have to decide between paying for an Uber and fighting the impulse to just drive themselves home. And you know what happens to the impulse after you've had a couple. So be safe out there, all right? All right, there you go. That's it. That is all we got. The Dow off less than 0.1% today. Finished at 18,456.
The NASDAQ up about a 3%, 51.54. The S&P 500 up as well, a 10%, 21.70. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.